Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Professor Tore Jansson of Stockholm University about his book, The History of Languages, an Introduction. This very wide-ranging book, drawing on Professor Jansson's extensive research, discusses the role of historical factors on the development and spread of language, from the familiar cases of Latin and Greek to the languages of Southern Africa and Australia. In this interview, we talk about some of these developments. We discuss the cultural importance of written language to the durability of the Egyptian civilization, and the role of literature in the formation of the modern nation-state. And we speculate a little about whether technological developments will lead to new patterns of change in the future. My guest today is Tore Jansson of Stockholm University, and we're talking about his book, The History of Languages, an Introduction. It's a very lucid and readable book discussing the patterns of language development from a historical perspective. Tore, your academic career seems to position you ideally to write this book. Could you tell us a little about your work?
Well, I started out in the field of classics and actually in the field of Latin literature, where I earned my doctorate a long time ago. Later on, I got more interested in the linguistic aspects of language study and took a great deal of interest in developments from Latin to the Romance languages, Italian, French, and so on. But from there, I somehow managed to widen my sphere of research to the general problems concerning changes in languages, and that was the reason actually that I started studying some languages in Southern Africa, because I was eager to find out certain facts about changes that seemed to be going on there. That turned out to be a long-standing occupation. So in fact, for a couple of decades, I worked with Latin and with African languages in tandem, more or less, all the time, trying to find out more about language change and especially its relations to changes in societies. That's a very brief summary of my way towards the present, my present interests, which are still very much centered around this field, more or less in between history and language.
And this book draws on your earlier work, Speak, A Short History of Languages, which was published by OUP in 2002. What does this volume do differently?
Well, in the first place, of course, it's written about a decade later, or a little more, actually. So the perspective is slightly different, mainly because I've worked more with those questions and problems. It's a book that incorporates a great deal of what's in the earlier book, but it adds some other and more, perhaps more general perspectives. It also adds a number of chapters on areas that weren't covered at all in the earlier book. Primarily, I include chapters on Chinese, on Arabic, and a few other areas.
Turning to the beginning of your book, you start by discussing the emergence of language. And as you point out, many ideas have been put forward as to the evolutionary motivation for language as an innovation. Are there, in your view, any outstanding candidate explanations?
The problems are long-standing, and unfortunately, it doesn't seem likely that we will ever get any very full or certain answers to the questions about how and why the linguistic capacity of humans developed. There are almost as many theories as there have been scholars working in the field. My view would be that the primary reason or factor behind the development of language is the fact that human beings are primarily living in close-knit societies with them, and are communicating a lot with each other. This is true, of course, for other or many other primates, but for some reason, our species has developed the gift of communication to a much higher degree than any other species, and the path towards present time of present types of languages may have been actually quite long. We know that our ancestors diverged from other surviving kinds of primates a very long time ago, several million years ago. And it may be that our ancestors had precursors to language that were much more advanced systems of communication than are found among any other animals, but still were quite far from what we have now. But unfortunately, we cannot trace those stages, and we will never be able to do that, I'm afraid.
You illustrate that point very effectively by considering the comparison between the languages spoken by two groups of hunter-gatherer societies, those of southern Africa, as you mentioned just now, and those of Australia. And you make the point that their languages are themselves very distinct from one another, at least in formal aspects. Does that degree of difference suggest that it's impossible to guess any of the specific properties of early human language?
Human languages are vary over a very wide spectrum, and people who live as gatherers and hunters, as everyone did up to around 10,000 years ago, they usually have languages that are spoken only by fairly few people. So in areas where there are or have been gatherers and hunters around, even in this century, you'll find many languages, hundreds of languages. And two such areas are southern Africa, where you find the Khoisan languages, and Australia, where you find several hundred languages spoken by the original inhabitants. Those languages have many properties that are quite different. The generally speaking, different Khoisan languages are quite different from each other, but even more different from most languages in the other parts of the world. And likewise with the Australian languages, they are very divergent among themselves, but they're also unlike all other languages. So there is really a great variety of languages that we can see must have been there as early as we can trace languages, which isn't very far back in time, actually. In areas where there has where writing has existed, of course, we can trace languages back to the beginning of writing, and with the reconstruction a few millennia before that, of course. Beyond that, we know nothing or very little about the actual shape of languages, and they may be very different shapes.
It's interesting that you mentioned writing. My impression was that throughout your book, at least from chapter 3 onwards or thereabouts, you devote more attention to written language than a lot of linguists seem to do. Is that your feeling?
Well, yes, I do that, certainly, because I believe, in the first place, of course, it's necessary for anyone interested in language change to look at written languages, because by and large, written languages is what we have to in order to know anything about what languages were like a long time ago. But in the second place, I believe that the invention of writing was the single most important invention in the history of humans. It's a very, very important tool for any society. You know, it happened at the time when some societies had developed from the stage of gatherers and hunters to the situation when people became settled farmers. And farmers needed societies of a different kind, with more social context, more organization, and also more administration. You need to cooperate more, and that means you have to keep track of who has done what, who is going to pay for this, and so on. And that was the beginning of language. It was a written language. So written language originated as a tool for a very practical purpose, but it turned out that it could be used and has been used for very many other important purposes, and that that the written form of languages interplay in very important ways with the spoken forms.
You make the interesting point that, as you put it, the hardest part of building a literate society may be finding uses for literacy. Could you develop that point?
Well, that's one way of putting it. It is, of course, a very important step to invent a way of representing language by signs of some kind, signs that can be looked at and read. This has been done, actually, at least three times in human history, it seems. Definitely the first time was around 5,000 years ago, by the Sumerians. Then independently, as it seems, about 3,500 years ago by the Chinese, and then considerably later in the Mayan culture in Central America. It may have been invented in other places too, although it has never been extensively recorded. So it seems that the idea, while it's a brilliant and original idea, it may have come to people in several places, but it doesn't become important until people start using it for something useful. And in order to use it, it's not enough for one or two people to know about it. You have to have a number of people knowing it, meaning that there has to be some kind of education, let's call it that at least. People have to learn it, and fairly large number of people have to learn. So written language, which means society where people have the time to spend learning fairly abstract way of handling language, and have the resources to use it for various things. Once you have that, of course, it's extremely useful, but it requires an organization, so it will be used in organized states, such as, for example, the old Egypt was, with the strong central power that could command people in many parts of the country and organize hundreds of thousands of people. They had to have written language, otherwise it would have been impossible. On the other hand, their neighbors to the south and to the north at that stage had no use for it, because their societies were different. Partly because of that, written language hasn't spread at an even rate everywhere. It was invented and used 5,000 years ago in around Euphrates and Tigris and around the Nile, but it didn't spread to Europe until 1,000 years later, didn't spread to southern Africa until, a few hundred years ago. In spite of the fact that there have always been connections between Egypt and Africa south of the Sahara. The people south of the Sahara didn't have use for the written language.
Later on, you discuss a similar question about the spread of internal Latin and Arabic, where you point out some of the curious, at least superficially curious, regional variations in the way they spread and the extent to which they spread. For instance, the absence of Latin in England after the Romans and the absence of Arabic in Persia. Do you feel that linguists tend to underappreciate the role of non-linguistic historical factors in these processes?
Well, yes, I think so. It may also be that historians may underestimate the importance of the linguistic factors. Actually, those are problems that should be approached in common by linguists and historians, I think. But this, unfortunately, is not so often done. As for Persian, for example, it is true, as you said, that in Persia, present Iran, Arabic never became the main language, although the country was conquered by Arabs, and for a long time it seemed likely that the country would become Arabic. However, for cultural and political reasons, Persian had a renaissance, and Arabic retreated again. Although it, of course, remains an important language in the country, being the language that carries the Muslim religion, which is extremely important in Iran. But there is no equation, necessary equation between belief and language use. Just because you are a Muslim, you don't necessarily use or speak Arabic, of course. It may be a strong incentive, and in some cases, religion does really affect a shift of language, but much more often it's a political factor. The same thing with Latin in Britain, of course. The Roman armies and the Roman administration kept Britain for around 300 years, and there certainly were quite a few speakers of Latin in the country around 400 AD. When the Roman political power collapsed, the incentive to speak Latin wasn't great, the actual number of Latin speakers was too small. It turned out to make it possible for the language to survive.
Turning to Greek, you beautifully illustrate the concept of language's creation by pointing out some of the concepts identified by Greek thinkers which have been passed down to Western civilization in general. Do you feel that we're still shaped by those categories, that in some sense, if that culture had not happened to encode those concepts, that we would actually conceive of reality in general in a very different way?
Yes. Yes, I believe so. It's, of course, not exclusively a linguistic fact. Perhaps, some linguists would say it has little to do with linguistics. But the fact is that because of developments in Greece in the classical times, several centuries before our era, we still have in all European languages a large number of words that come from Greek directly or indirectly, and the words represent concepts that are inevitably part of our culture, our civilization. You know, the Greeks defined, they invented concepts such as mathematics or categories, philosophy, of course. Those are concepts that we use and in a way cannot escape from. It's very hard to conceive of a mental word where the concept of mathematics, for example, doesn't exist in the mind of a person educated in the West Western culture. And this has been so since the Greeks, and if they hadn't defined it that way, it hadn't become part of our culture. So in that way, languages are, to a large extent, repositories of past achievements, let's say that. And it is in a story. Well, it didn't happen inevitably. It could have happened in other areas with other languages. The Greeks could have spoken something else. But now the Greeks did it. They spoke Greek, and so the Greek language became extremely influential.
There's, I guess, a tension there between the notion of discovering something and the notion of inventing it. And I suppose this speaks to two logically possible positions about the nature of culture and civilization in general. My impression is that you tend to lean towards the belief that things are invented rather than discovered, that you think of these developments as very much human creations and artifacts rather than things that are out there in the ether waiting to be encoded and brought forth.
Well, that's true. In that way, I'm what philosophers, I suppose, would describe as nominalist. I don't believe that our minds work mainly with concepts and ideas that were ingrained in them by birth, but I think we learn most of what we know, and if you believe that, then it's true that things were invented and we learn them or build upon them.
Let me change the subject slightly. And returning to chapter 2 of your book, you discuss large language groups there, and you focus especially on Indo-European and the Bantu languages, both of which we've talked about a little in the beginning of this interview. Why those groups in particular?
Well, I think they are good examples of the large language groups that dominate the world nowadays. If we go back slightly, I talked about those languages of gatherers and hunters. They are very many. They are very dissimilar, so that one has to imagine that 10,000 years ago, there were very many languages that were spoken in many places with few speakers for each language. Now, what happened after that must have been that some groups expanded at the expense of many others, so that groups tended to be much larger. And then, of course, they split as they became successful. They migrated in various directions. And by this process, groups, originally fairly small groups, could spread their language to large areas, and those areas then got large numbers of let's say, descendants of one original language, the original language of a very successful group. But this is obviously what happened with Indo-European languages. We know very little about who the Indo-Europeans were, but obviously some group or related groups spoke Indo-European several thousand years before our era, and their language gave rise to several hundred languages that are spoken now. Well, well over 100 at least, depending very much on how you count them. Likewise, the Bantu languages spread over most of Africa, south of the Sahara, beginning around 3 or 4,000 years before now. And nowadays there are several hundred Bantu languages spoken in that area. This process has happened in many parts of the world, so that the world is dominated by a few such large language families, say 20 or 30, depending on how far you go. And then there, of course, are still a number of small languages, but the most of us in the world speak a language belonging to one of the families. And of course, in Europe and in Asia, and nowadays on all continents, the Indo-European language family is the most well represented.
In part four of your book, when you turn back to Indo-European, you talk about the emergence of linguistic identity in the nation state. Presumably this is something where there's a very different dynamic in the spread of Indo-European to the spread of the Bantu languages.
Oh, yes. In the Bantu area, you can hardly speak about nation states in the way they are found in Europe until the 19th century or the 20th century, really, because of a completely different cultural and historical background. The nation state is something that was created by and by in Europe, the idea that a certain group of people belong together and should have a state all by themselves, ideally, everyone speaking the same language. That idea of a nation state is not very old, actually. It's the first ideas of this kind turn up in the late Middle Ages, and basically it's the nation states are things that are entities that you find in Europe from 600 or 700 years ago and on, that the old large states such as the Roman Empire or Arabic Empire and so on, they weren't nation states in that way, because this idea of a people that everyone should belong to never was there in that way. It's part of a European, we can call it ideology or an idea of how states should function.
And this idea or ideology is underpinned by a lot of political will and also a great deal of cultural capital. And you talk about the linguistic or language-related content of that and the way that emerged in Europe in the 16th, 17th centuries and thereabouts.
Yes. Of course, Europe at that time was still, culturally speaking, very much dominated by one language, Latin. I now talk of Western Europe, the part of Europe that was dominated by the Western Christian Church. You first had the Roman Empire and then the Christian Church, which had chosen Latin as its main vehicle. And for many centuries, Latin was virtually the only written languages in the whole of Western Europe. and on Central Europe, as far east as Poland and Czechia and so on, and Hungary, and other languages didn't become written languages until, broadly speaking, 1,000 years ago. English was one of the very first. It has traditions down to the 7th century as a written language. But Latin dominated in England as everywhere as the written language for a long time. Only in the 12th, 13th, 14th century did European countries find it less satisfactory to rely mainly on Latin, and the states actually became, and the leaders of the states, the political leaders, kings and others, and the leading classes became interested in using written language more for various purposes, administration, but also very much literature, things connected with cultural life, so that the new written languages such as French, Spanish, Italian, later on German, even later Netherlands, Swedish, and so on. They became languages that, in a way, competed with Latin and tried to take the place of Latin. And then, of course, they had to become developed languages. That is, they had to have a standard, as Latin had, a strict standard for spelling and so on, correctness. Preferably, they should also have a great literature, so that people started writing in the languages, and that is the great era of, first great era of European, truly European literature. It has a lot to do with the political aspirations of the states where this literature was written.
A question that struck me reading that was whether you see the same need for identity and the linguistic role of identity prevailing now and in the future, or whether things are now sufficiently post-nation state kind of environment that people are going to be more willing to give up their language or not to see it as a badge of identity in quite the same way.
Oh, well, it is possible. It's not easy to get a perspective, obviously, on recent developments. Certainly, by and large, in the 20th and 21st centuries, almost all nation states of the traditional kind, both in Europe and in other continents, still are very much interested in promoting their own language for practical and ideological reasons. However, what has happened in our century is, of course, very important. One thing is the enormous expansion of education, which means that people in all parts of the world nowadays have got formal training in reading and writing in their first language quite often, but also very often in another language. In some parts of the world, you only get training in reading and writing English, not in your native language. This, of course, means that there is a possibility that wasn't available at any earlier time in human history for people to choose to operate in another language than the language, than the first language they learned. This, I would say, well, it happens a lot, of course, in many societies now. I'm a Swede. I live in Sweden. I know that, well, I can still remember the situation about half a century ago. At that time, English was known by several Swedes, but wasn't actually used very much, nor was any other foreign language. At this time, English is used extensively in many contexts, and virtually all Swedes know it. And of course, it's possible within a fairly long time that Sweden becomes a truly bilingual society. However, it seems that for the time being, most Sweden, just as many other countries, will develop rather into a society with a strong second language, which most people know. But in the long run, of course, this may mean that the other language, the larger language, may take over completely. But again, it has to do with politics to a very large extent. As long as you have a Swedish government, for example, which is interested in a Swedish identity for political and cultural reasons, there will be a very strong incentive to keep and to promote the Swedish language. And there are no prospects, I think, for a swift development towards much fewer languages in the world. But within a few hundred years, many things may happen.
Well, in the meantime, I must say I feel very fortunate to be able to conduct this interview in English. Feel at something of a disadvantage if we were in Swedish. Speaking to you, I'd also feel at something of a disadvantage if we were to converse in Latin, as mine is very limited. When you talk about the birth and death of languages in your book, although you emphasise the importance of languages as cultural capital, actually you prefer not to use the term language death. Do you feel that term is unduly emotive?
It is a motive. Of course, it may, perhaps not incorrectly, it's a sad thing when a cultural achievement such as a language that has developed over hundreds of years or thousands of years just disappears. On the other hand, language death is perhaps a little, it's a very dramatic expression. What happens in almost all cases, well, fortunately, isn't that people are actually killed or that the language ends because a population just disappears. What happens is that people shift to another language, usually a language with more speakers. And that shift is rarely sudden. It happens over several generations. You could imagine such a change happening with my own language, Swedish. I don't think it will in the foreseeable future, but it could happen. You know, the first step is that everyone or almost everyone in the community learns a second language, as Swedes have already done. Then that language, for some social reason, tends to take over. usually because there are many speakers at the ground, it's not very likely that Swedish will change now, because we have, well, few native speakers of English in the country. But of course, that may change too. But it's much easier to change to language where you when you meet native speakers of that language all the time. So most instances of language death is with when or language shift is when a group shifts to a language that's spoken by their neighbors or people who live in the same town or in the same part of the country. This, on the other hand, happens a lot with small communities, so that the number of languages in the world becomes smaller. This is in many ways deplorable. On the other hand, this is a process that didn't start now. It started when people started farming, as we talked about, and it's still ongoing. So the long-term process is that small languages disappear in favor of larger languages. And as yet, we cannot see an end to that process. I don't believe it will end in the extreme situation that everyone on Earth will speak one language, because there are factors talking against that. But I'm sure there will be fewer languages, and probably much smaller number of languages in 100 years from now than it is now.
In the final part of your book, you talk about some of these trends and you provide some more detailed speculations about future developments. One angle you don't emphasize there, which I'd be very interested to hear your views on, is whether there are some recent and future technological developments, such as telecoms, automated language tools, perhaps even biological engineering, which could change the game unrecognizably as far as language development is concerned. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's not so difficult to think about it. The difficult thing is to know what will be important. So far, in the last 100-150 years, we have had a number of important inventions in the field of linguistic communication, starting with the telephone and then the radio, the television, film with sound, movies with soundtrack, etc., etc. And of course, now it's the almost unlimited possibilities for communication over the internet. This is important, but what it does, of course, is making it possible for more people to speak in the way they have always spoken. Automatic translation is interesting, and most linguists would take the view that, it is certainly technologically possible to translate fast from one language to another in oral communication. The quality is debatable. It hasn't been possible in practice so far. I don't think the problem is unsolvable when it comes to ordinary everyday conversation. Even automatic translation of written texts, as you know, it's found the quality is not very high when it comes to complicated texts. With simple texts, nowadays works reasonably well, but it has taken several decades to come to that stage. So whether we'll find situations where people speak without real problems with each other through some machine that translates from one language to another? I don't know. I doubt it, partly because of the fact that spoken languages vary and spoken languages change faster and more dramatically than written languages do, which means that you would have to have extremely adaptable programs or algorithms for actually keeping up with what's happening all the time in the languages. And then there are all the ordinary problems of translation. It's not easy and sometimes even theoretically impossible to translate all the sense of an utterance in one language into another. But you shouldn't say too much. It may change our linguistic environment. And of course, if you do that, it may not be so necessary as it is now to learn foreign languages. We'll see.
Well, our time is nearly up, but to conclude, I must ask, on the blurb of your book, it refers to your retirement in 2001 from the University of Gothenburg. And since then, you've done very many things. Where do you see your research taking you next?
Well, my age, I think it may be wise not to have plans for more than a very short time in front of you. But actually, I am writing on a book which deals with the Germanic peoples and languages. The Germanic languages, of course, are the languages spoken in Northern and Western Europe, such as German, English, Dutch, and Swedish, Norwegian, Danish, and so on. And all those languages are related. The original speakers were called the Germani by the Romans. That's from where we have in English the term Germans. But it included all the people speaking in that way and living beyond the border of the Roman Empire. So I write something about those people beginning in antiquity and trying to follow up what happened to them and to their languages up to the present time.
Well, I wish you every success with the book and hopefully many more to follow.
Thank you very much.
But in the meantime, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Chris. Goodbye.
I've been talking to Tore Jansson about his book, The History of Languages. This is Chris Cummins from New Books in Language, saying thanks for listening.